good evening, everyone. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November in approximately 5 minutes, top of the hour, 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We'll begin this evening's Thursday informational net, where we're going to be talking about the second part, coastal radar, high power radar, waterfall displays, and signal processing. Hopefully you'll join us, and hopefully you'll have a lot of fun. So until the top of the hour, I'll stay in the background. Good evening, everyone. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and this is SouthCars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This net is conducted under the guidelines of the SouthCars organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 and Good Amateur Practice. This SouthCar server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, provided by Kilo Bravo 8 Zulu Golf Lima, and all contacts and requests for information will be handled through the net control. When contact with another station is made, please move off the system and establish your contact direct so the net may continue. In fairness to all, short-time stations will not be recognized as such. All stations will be worked in the order in which they've checked in. Information regarding our HF operation may be found at www.southcars.com and for this digital operation at www.voip.southcars.com. Your net control actually for this session is George in 070. And I'm just merely opening up this evening. My name is Kathy. My call sign is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. My location is Port St. Lucie, Florida, where it's probably in the 80s. I haven't had a chance to check it out, but it's been a beautiful day and hopefully a beautiful night. So prior to starting, I'd like to ask if there's any emergency traffic or anything out of the ordinary that needs to be handled at this time. If so, please come aboard. Well, hearing no emergency traffic, that's always a great thing. But how about anyone celebrating their birthday this week or maybe the upcoming week that would like to jump aboard so we could say happy, happy birthday? Well, you know what? I know someone who's celebrating a birthday next week, and that's the reason our TIN is this week, and that's myself, Kilo 6 Sierra United November. I celebrate my birthday next Thursday. So I'll wish myself a happy, happy birthday. Well, everyone, this is the TIN open forum. This is the monthly Thursday Informational Net open forum, or TIN for short. This net is conducted to provide information pursuant to amateur-related subjects and or other areas of general interest to those participating. All are encouraged to participate and ask questions of our guest speaker or speakers. And I do want to advise all stations connected to this net this evening that it will be recorded for future presentation on our website as a podcast. All stations participating will be part of that recording. And once again, welcome everyone to our TIN this evening. And like I said in the announcement, our subject is coastal radar, high power radar, waterfall displays, and signal processing. And we have a great program for you and some great guest speakers. So at this point, I'm going to throw it over to you, Mr. George, N070. Hopefully you'll have a grand evening, and thanks for being there.
Okay, 6SUN, the net N070. Thank you, Kathy, and happy birthday. And I was singing happy birthday at the top of my lungs when the microphone was off in the last couple minutes. So that is really congratulations on the birthday. I hear that you and Gordon are going to be having a special trip out, or that he's probably not going to make you cook that night, is what I hear. So anyway, thank you for being there, Kathy, and I appreciate so much your role in making these TINs happen as well. The weather here in Nottingham, Maryland, is in the mid to high 50s with a forecast of a lower 30s degree temperature over the weekend. So we may have some cold weather coming in. So that's the weather forecast from here. Let me break. And I do want to acknowledge everyone who's taking the time out to come join us for the TIN tonight. Thank you, and it's a very special to have you here. I'd like to acknowledge those also listening by RF and the repeaters who we may not be able to see on EchoLink, and thank you for being there as well. So today's Thursday Informational Net TIN Educational Resource is a continuation of last month's discussion of HARP, Over the Horizon Radars, High Power RF Facilities, and Coastal Radars. And we'll be going into the topics that Kathy mentioned, Coastal Radar and Signal Processing Waterfall Displays. This is a special South Cars Net because we will be using a slightly different format like we did last time. We will use EchoLink for the net. We also will provide for you to enjoy, if you desire, additional fund material in the form of web page addresses for you to look at during and after the net. Please note that we are not referencing the user comments on those web pages, only the primary topic. And you may go to voip.southcars.com and click on the Read More link underneath the picture to bring up the supplemental page that you want to take a look at. South Cars reminds you to practice good computer hygiene when accessing websites and to protect your own computers and devices. An up-to-date firewall and virus program are a must before you access any web pages anywhere. As I mentioned also, your South Cars support team highly recommends that you do open and use the additional reference material posted on the South Cars website tonight. First, go to the main website page, click on the picture, then click on the Read More link under the picture, then scroll down to the reference material paragraph and click on the link. You'll then see today's reference material. Now, because of the significant time, effort, and contributions of so many people to this special platform, it is only fair to acknowledge their contributions. Before I run into that, let me ask if anyone on the net needs any help getting to the reference material. If so, please call now. Over. Okay, nothing heard. So, for tonight's TIN, the executive producer and South Cars Net Manager is Kathy, K6SUN. Gordon, KY6V, is editor extraordinaire, chief bottle washer, and best script scrubber. Backup net control stations and real-time producers are Chief Roger W4RFJ, who's the Chief Coffee Pot Watcher, and the Admiral, who's the Chief Coffee Pot Filler, also, and the ever-patient Gordon KY6V. Website synchronization and support by Steve KF5VH and Gordon KY6V, and yours truly researched and wrote portions of this as well. And so appreciate your being there for the TIN to listen tonight. I also need to acknowledge the contributions to this educational forum from various websites, the YouTube video website under Fair Use and Creative Commons Attribution Licensing Agreements, and from public governmental, military, and public marketing material intended for general dissemination. Fair use is made of these resources, and their contribution is hereby acknowledged with gratitude. Attribution via YouTube license include Kurt Rowlett, EA1GAR, First Token, Nick Hacko, TonyNYC46, and Utility Planet on YouTube. Academic resources include the University of California at San Diego, and government resources include IOOS.NOAA.gov, the Southern California Ocean Observation System, and domestic and international government websites. All trademarks remain the property of the linked website's owners. Governmental, academic, news services, and public scientific and safety websites' contributions available to all radio operators, shortwave listeners, and the general public over the public internet are acknowledged and referenced under fair use. Their contribution to this TIN is hereby acknowledged with gratitude. Attribution of the private photo, governmental, academic, news services, public scientific, and safety audio and video credits are also contained in the linked web page and server. No intentional misuse has been made, and gratitude is extended for all resources used in this educational forum. Okay, so now that we have all of that out of the way, let me say, welcome to part two of the HAARP Coastal Radar and Wave Form and Signal Processing TIN. Once again, we'll be using the program reference material page on the VOIP.southcars.com website as outlined for your enjoyment and after TIN. A word about the reference page and the pace of the Echolink audio from the net. Please note that the Echolink audio portion is an outline to the links contained in the supplement, because the run length of some resources in the supplement is longer than the Echolink time slot available. You will want to have pen and paper handy to write down the topic link numbers that you want to learn more about. You may then return after the net to examine any of the links on the reference material webpage in more detail and at a more leisurely pace. So on tonight's TIN, we will learn about the coastal radars, waterfall displays of over-the-horizon and over-the-horizon backscatter radar signals. The advantage of coastal radar to our environment and ecology will be discussed. And we will also propose one possible answer to last TIN's question about radar displays, where we're even going to take a brief attempted look into the future. Finally, we will use our imagination to see if we can imagine a possible use of coastal radar to find boats, military, and commercial targets on the ocean out to about 200 kilometers. So first, let me ask if there are any net members who would be willing to describe what you have learned about HAARPs and over-the-horizon radars after listening to last month's first TIN, either live or by podcast, and about the high-power RF units. Any net member interested in describing what you may have learned or found interesting, please call NO70 now. Over.
Six, Victor.
Six, Victor. KY6V, NO70. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, thanks, George. Good evening to everybody that's checked in here so far. Gordon, KY6V. To answer your last question, I'll tell you what. I've been following portions of this, you know, for years. But when we got into your program last month and the research that was ongoing for the program here this evening, I am just amazed at the worldwide involvement, and primarily, I would say, probably based on a military objective. Secondly, I'd say that the conspiracy theories of what all of this is about is just as long as it is wide. You know, I knew of several of the conspiracy thoughts, but, you know, reshaping your mind and all of this, reshaping the weather, but the list just goes on and on and on. And lastly, the complexity and the let's say expense of putting these facilities together is outstanding, you know, monumental. So keep us informed, George. KY6V, back to net.
KY6V, NO70. Gordon, when we first started looking at this, when it was just a gleam in South Carolina's eye, I thought I was going to have trouble putting together information to fill out any more than 5 minutes. I was amazed at what came out of the other end, and very grateful for all the net members' patience as the list grew and grew and grew. And I have learned so much from this as well. So I appreciate what you have shared with us about what you've learned, Gordon, and it. It is amazing what I think what's happening. So thank you for sharing that with us. Are there any other stations who would like to fill us in on what you might have learned since last time? Please call NO70. Over. Okay, nothing heard. So now we move to tonight's topics of coastal radar and waterfall display analysis. I'd like to again to acknowledge that Gordon, KY6V, and Chief W4RFJ have kindly consented to help with taking portions of tonight's program and reading portions of that so that we have variety and none of us gets too worn out. So, Gordon, I'd like to invite you back. Will you please give us an introduction to coastal radar theory? Also, where are the coastal radars set up? Can they be inland, or do they have to be constructed next to the water's surface at the beach? And any other thoughts you might have? KY6V from NO70. Over.
Well, I'd be happy to give it a go. George, thank you. You know, I have to admit, I was sitting back here a couple of minutes ago thinking about last month's program and what we're doing here this evening. And it's just grand in nature. I don't expect or think that, you know, any of the hams that we're addressing here are going to go out and put a radar antenna on the top of their house. But it's interesting, guys and gals, to think about the technology that's involved in what we're talking about. What can be accomplished with that technology? And how it is already playing in other things that we do within our hobby. And I'm referring to digital communication. I'm referring to waterfall displays and spectrum analysis and so on and so forth that's becoming every day. So he who takes the time, or she, to think about the techniques that we're trying to discuss here will have a broader technical base from which to enjoy their hobby. So let me buy a nickel here, and we'll get into George's questions on coastal radar. Okay, coastal radar is used to look out to sea, to record speed and direction of the ocean surface currents, monitor movement of floating objects, including disabled vessels and stranded people and distressed people, and you know, all of this in the water. It is located near the water's edge. That was one of the questions that you had, George. Coastal radar requires special setup and portability of the radar antenna apparatus, and you know, once placed, these HF radars can measure ocean wave patterns from a few feet offshore up to about 200 kilometers. Let's see, 200 kilometers, that's about 120 miles in any weather condition. Therefore, large areas can be measured by the radar return. With the detail required for storage of large sets of metadata used for computer processing to identify and isolate wanted and unwanted radio returns, there's just a lot going on, guys and gals. The highly sophisticated computer processing algorithms require extensive detail about ocean wave statistics and other analytical tools. Not even the satellites, now think about this, not even the satellites have the necessary resolution in terms of separation between objects and the passing of time between radar signals of the object that are required for this supercomputer processing. I'd like to draw your attention at this point to link 67A on our website for this program. That's 67 Alpha, and that will give you some additional information when you have time to look at it. The goal of this supercomputing of coastal radar data is to know what assets and risks exist by looking at ocean wave returns and temperatures. Additionally, input systems from other electronic surveillance methods may be combined with coastal radar for computer analysis. Let me take a break here and rejuvenate everybody's timer. Okay. Took a sip of water. This throat is still acting up on me, George. Computer analysis is used also to process the radar return data to automatic eliminate unwanted echoes, impulses, RF, and known ship profiles. computer analysis also helps to determine the best placement of the radar apparatus. Excuse me. You want to take it for a minute, George, and point them to 67 Alpha, over.
Okay, well, 6 feet, 70. Sure will. I'd be happy to, Gordon. Just type in the text box if you feel, if your throat feels like coming back in. So the computer analysis that's used to process the radar return can eliminate unwanted echoes and impulses in RFI and eliminate known ship profiles to identify the unknown ship profiles. See sections B and A on pages 2 and 1 in that order in link 67A1. Now, we know that coastal radar is used to analyze ocean surface waves. Waves can be caused by gravitational, frictional, lunar tidal, and temperature differences all create ocean waves. Not radio waves, but the material, the water waves of the ocean. Temperature differences happen also when warmer water is mixed with cooler water. For example, when a land river empties into the cooler ocean water. The land river water is frequently warmer from the effects of population, wastewater discharge, and warmer land emptying into tributaries that feed into the ocean. Coastal radar wave patterns are used to identify changes in the ocean waves for other military and civilian reasons we will discuss in a moment. What is needed for a usable coastal radar image in a radar return for the image to be usable is, and also usable for storage as large data sets, can be used as predictions of coastal ocean waves, for example, tsunamis and other unique events. So how is that radar signal generated? For coastal radar current mapping, radar needs to have bearing, range, and speed or fix of the radar target, meaning the ocean wave. A time series of the received sea radar echo from the ocean wave surface is processed by computer to determine the bearing, range, and speed of the ocean wave. When we collect bearing, range, and speed or fix of a radar target, the returns can be matched by supercomputer analysis to known patterns of ocean wave behavior that result from a specific set of coastal influences. For example, we know patterns of boats or individuals. We know patterns of underwater structures. We know patterns of breaks in the ocean surface by objects, such as boats or smaller objects, even people in the water, and we know the height and frequency of the ocean waves themselves. And there are multiple examples on both coasts of the United States where coastal radar is used to monitor thermal differences in the water and the changes in ocean wave patterns when we compare those stored metadata sets with historical data from the radar returns. This means that we can also use coastal radar to look for water quality monitoring. For example, when land effluents flow from land into the ocean, when there are storms at sea, when there are disruptions in the normal wave pattern offshore from the ocean floor surfaces, peaks and valleys, from buried shifts, from schools of fish disrupting the ocean surface, and from thermal plumes affecting ocean wave patterns, for example, an underwater volcano or gaseous or heat discharge, you know, like a partially active volcano underwater, and other ocean wave diffractions. Now, I'm going to turn it back to Gordon so he can talk for a little more about the discussion of wastewater and water quality management, and for him to point out those links to you. So thank you, Gordon. Back to you, KY6V and 07F.
Okay. Thank you, George. KY6V here. Well, for a discussion of wastewater and water quality management applications of coastal radar, search for the heading of hazardous material spills, I would draw your attention to and scroll down on our website to 67 Alpha 2, 6782, which will give you a nice format to go along with what is being discussed here. To avoid confusing the radar with ground returns from land surfaces, the coastal radars have to be located at the water's edge. And sometimes they're actually almost a few feet into the water. This is why coastal radars are built to be mobile and are frequently relocated, for that matter. Note the... Note the seaside coastal radar installations at the San Francisco Area National Park. There's a transmitting antenna in the foreground and the receiving antenna in the far background, and that can all be viewed at link 67A3, 67 Alpha 3. Notice the antenna placement at water's edge. We keep coming back. It's right close to the water. And the ecological value of coastal radar at link 67B. At 67 Bravo. Let me buy a nickel for a second. Ocean surface water movements are determined by ocean currents. And I guess that makes sense. If we collect data on surface currents, there is the possibility to track pollutants, provides critical information for search and rescue, monitor harmful algae bloom, aid maritime navigation, assess the ecosystems, including land water influence from land rivers opening out into the ocean, etc., etc. And even satellite assessment cannot provide the detail that coastal and digital near real-time radar returns can provide. So because ocean waves are always present, there will always be a radar return image available for mapping of ocean currents. Continuous and frequent radar measurements and collections and storage of the return radar data are important to current and future uses of the radar return data. So pictures of the coastal return installation in South Florida, an extended in-depth documentation of coastal radar background, data management, and so on and so forth. I would refer you to our link 67C, 67 Charlie, and that'll bring you up to speed. Okay, at this point I'm going to turn it over to the one and only Chief. Will you tell us more about components of radar signaling, how the signal is multiplexed, frequencies offset in the signal, and call sign identification, and all that kind of nice stuff, and how you use the radar to heat your coffee. KY6V to W4RFJ.
Whoa! Hello, everybody. This is W4RFJ. Thank you, Skipper. And, wow, I'm just sitting back and taking this all in, and I'm thinking about, you know, one of the technologies that, and this is kind of like just came into my head. I don't know why I didn't think about this before, but, you know, a lot of this stuff, this analyzing, of course, using supercomputers, is largely in due to digital signal processing. I think we've gone leaps and bounds into handling this data. Anyway, there is an in-depth discussion of coastal radar spectrum management, frequency and time division, multiplexing, modulation techniques, and call sign identification with center frequency and offset frequency assignments, and coordination similar to our repeater coordination to avoid interference. Let me grab a nickel. Sorry about that. I had to shift my page up, too. Anyway, time division multiplexing, frequency division multiplexing, audio frequency offset, and audio sweeps are used to generate the radar signal. For the radar call sign identification, a time offset from the beginning of the radar sweep can be assigned that unique to a specific radar installation. When specific offsets in time or audio frequency are considered, the offsets can be compared to other known radar profiles, and when a combination is found that is different than any other's radar in the vicinity, then that combination can be assigned to the new radar. Sorry for the delay there. The radar signal can then be considered to be coordinated with other radars, and the potential for interference with return radar sweeps reduced or eliminated. This document will also help us to understand what we see in the waterfall analysis displays and how they relate to the radar wave transmission. Frequency assignment and radar modulation patterns are discussed at link 67 Delta. Okay, at this point, are there any NET members who have questions about the frequency or time divisions? Or are there any NET members who have spent time at the beach just watching an object bob up and down on top of the waves? And would you like to comment on how their visual observation may be compared to a coastal radar return? Please call W4RFJ.
NO70.
And 6 Victor.
Hey, Captain, go ahead. Jump on in here. This is W4RFJ turning it over to KY6B.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard, George was checking in there with you, too. Well, you know, I've spent a lot of pleasant times out there on the beach looking at the water and trying to pick out fish that were coming in on the waves and looking for bottles. Tell me, can this radar pick up the genie in the bottle? Or, you know, these secret messages that are put in a bottle asking for help with a cork on the bottle from some desert island on the other side of the world? KY6V, back to you, Roger.
Well, I'm not too familiar with how small of an item you can actually identify, but if it's monitoring ocean currents, I'm pretty sure it's pretty small objects. One of the things that I think I talk about here in a little bit, or I think George talks about, is the ability to analyze wave action to identify things that are under the water surface. So I hope I answered your question there, Skipper.
Yeah, you certainly did. Thanks, Raj. And pick up George, if you'd be so kind.
Oh, no problem. I did not hear him, but Mr. No Snow, go for it. W4RFJ.
W4RFJ NO70. Well, you know, regard to objects bobbing up on the top of waves, having spent quite a bit of my youth being a beachcomber, that's a whole other story, and having more than once come up from underwater. I love swimming underwater for distance and then coming up, and have more than once having come up from under the water and hit my head on a wood plank that happened to be right where I was coming up from under. And this was more than one time this happened. Then I started, before executing one of those underwater maneuvers, looking around and checking for anything that might be bobbing. And if it were a bottle or a piece of wood or, even another swimmer or something, I definitely spent some time looking at things bobbing around the ocean surface. And, of course, things underneath the surface also were usually a surprise. But, yeah, I found it to be a good idea when swimming to check for those wood planks. Okay, back to you, Chief, W4FJ NO70.
Okay, thank you very much, George. So I guess we'll continue on here. Once the coastal radar return can be seen by looking at the water surface and temperature changes, extremely valuable military, civilian, and even life-saving information can be seen in the radar returns. Tsunami detection and other marine threats are discussed by Professor Satoshi Fuji of the University of, and you know what, Gordon, this ties my tongue up even more, but I'm going to try it. Rukuyu's, and this is seen in Link 68. Let me grab a nickel. Okay, also, a map of the Earth globe with radar and tsunami location is shown at Link 68-1. And Link 68-1 tsunami and radar location map.jpg on the server. I think that's on the server that you're looking at for Link 68-1. Let me grab a nickel. I apologize. I'm trying something new here, and it's not working, so next time I'll definitely do it the way I did it last week. Anyway, coastal radar can also assist in ocean water quality monitoring and perform detailed environmental risk analysis. The South California Coastal Ocean Observing System uses multiple input streams to assess ocean water conditions. A map showing the input sources, including the HF radar sites and the green balloons along the coast, is available in the full screen view, Link 68 Alpha. Let me grab another nickel. Okay, with all that being said, I hope everybody got it. I understand you have additional information about how coastal radar returns can be used to protect life, limb, and property. Of course, they would help you identify those boards so you could avoid them. But sonar would do that too. But can they also be used to provide early detection of offshore activities and the presence of people and facilities? And how are these coastal radar sites constructed? Well, you have inquiring minds who would like to know. So November Oscars 7 Oscar from W4RFJ. Back over to you, George.
A W4RFJ and the net NO70. Thank you, Chief, and thank you, Gordon. With the, you have both pulled yeoman duty so far, and I think Chief is even going to have more for us later tonight. So, Chief, I think you had some good examples there of how coastal radar is so beneficial and necessary to our environmental and public service interests. Significant effort is required to establish a workable and economical coastal radar screen of near shore and offshore radar returns. These coastal radar returns and the limitations on placement of the radar antenna having to be right next to the ocean or partially in the edge of the ocean surface are interesting and varied in how they are used and interpreted. Freshwater placement of coastal radar also historically has not been used because freshwater is a poor conductor of RF energy. Now, as a ham operator, I found that interesting. To think about. Propagation of radio wave energy over fresh water is greatly reduced by the very poor conducting properties of fresh water. Salt crystals in salt water increase the conductivity. You can try this for yourself, or you may remember having tried this for yourself back in science class by placing electrodes connected to a light bulb in salt water and then trying it again in fresh water. And you will notice that in salt water, the light bulb will light up, but in fresh water, it will not. Because of the poor conductivity of fresh water, HF radar systems have very rarely been deployed along large freshwater bodies, such as the U.S. and Canadian Great Lakes. Some research has been commissioned to determine how to make freshwater radar workable, with guarded results and recommendations for further research. Please see page 2 of Link 68A1. Now, the technical side of making coastal radar happen and work includes both the required portability of the systems and critical land-sea placement to fill in coverage and coverage gaps. Also, the different radar return waveforms for coastal radar compared to over-the-horizon or surface radar require added knowledge and awareness of the wavelength of the radar wave. We're going to talk about that a little more in a bit. Let's talk about how the ocean's rough wave surface activity can act like a large diffraction grating, affecting radar wavelength and detection of wave heights visible at one wavelength and not another. Because these are only visible at one wavelength and not another, according to the radar wavelength, this is why we have to have multiple scans of an ocean wave surface, more than in land surface returns where land radar is looking at the contour of the soil and land inland. So are there any NET members present tonight who have ever seen a portable coastal radar setup on a beach that you were visiting, or maybe passed by a Coast Guard station and seen the Coast Guard station radar antenna in operation? Now, have any of you have driven by any of the stations, and if so, where were they? I'd love to know if any of you have done this. Any station that has seen this and would like to tell us about it and where it was located, please call NO70. Over.
6 Victor with a comment.
Please, Gordon, KY6V, NO70.
Yeah, thanks, George. No, I don't think I've ever seen one of the coastal guys, you know, up close. But I'll tell you what just absolutely boggled my mind. And that's the link that you have at 68 Alpha, which was covered by Roger here just a few minutes ago. This is a display, guys and gals, you've got to look at. It's a display of where the radars are located along the California coast. And man, they're right on top of each other from one end, the Mexican end, up to the Oregon end of the state. And as I recall, you know, California, of course, is a long state but not very wide in comparison. It's probably 1,000 miles or better. And it looks to me like these radars are positioned about every 25 miles, maybe, possibly 50. It just blew my mind that all of this was happening and the world didn't know about it, particularly me. Go ahead, George, KY6V.
KY6V, NO70. That was a good pickup, too, Gordon, because, yes, these coastal radars do have to be placed very close to one another. They are so focused to go farther out into the ocean because they are having to look at the wave, ocean wave heights, and those heights have to match the radar wave length frequency. If you recall, there's the formula for frequency versus wavelength, like 80 meters is, you know, the 3.75 to, no, 3.5, whatever, you know, that close in that range. So that if you apply the same formula to coastal, to ocean waves, then that's why they are so close together, because you're looking out at ocean waves straight out, and then to see the pattern of the effluent and the offshore activity, it takes them to be that close together. Let me reset. So that brings us then to the topic of how does the coastal radar see an image of the sea waves? Well, the radar signal brushes over the sea looking for changes in the sea's surface. The coastal radars look for anomalies in the ocean wave return, including the possible presence of a marine craft. There is an interesting limitation of a radar when looking at ocean waves. There is a coastal radar return only when the radar signals scatters off a sea wave of one half the radar wavelength in a direct radio path either from or towards the radar. So the coastal radar has to look straight at the wave, and the wave height has to be half of the radar frequency's wavelength. This direct radio path limitation requires multiple coastal radar installations closer together than would be required for land-based radar. A greater number, therefore, of portable coastal radar installations are required for the same distance to be covered to maintain this direct emission path from or towards the radar. And another interesting limitation on coastal radar is that the radar wavelength has to match a resonant ocean wave height. averaging the returns over time, and by looking at the backscatter return as well as the direct radar return, then the scattered radar electromagnetic waves can add together coherently to form a strong return of energy at a very precise wavelength. Now, this wavelength limitation for coastal radar is known as the Bragg principle, B-R-A-G-G, Bravo, Romeo, Alpha, Golf, Golf. And the phenomenon is known as Bragg scattering. For example, at 4 to 50 megahertz, the Bragg scattering short ocean waves are between 1.5 and 5 seconds. Because ocean waves are always present, as we mentioned earlier, there will always be a radar return image available for the mapping of these currents. So we can see a history of the importance of Bragg scattering in coastal radar research in the section entitled Background, and the subparagraph labeled History. You can do a text search in the document at link 68A2. And let me just add in here that the principle of Bragg scattering is so core to coastal radar, it is worth taking a second look at. So I will go into a little more detail on that, but before I do, let me ask if there are any NET members who can remember their amateur licensing classes and questions and can give me the formula for calculating wavelength when given a frequency like 25 megahertz. First station to call with the correct wavelength formula receives the prize of being recognized for their achievement. Please call NO70.
Well, Six Victor will throw my hat at it.
Thank goodness. I was afraid I was going to have to refer them to the extra class license, KY6VNO70.
Hey, that's a good time for a plug, too, you know, guys and gals. The extra class license sponsored by South Cars is coming up here starting July the 10th, and it'll be a six-week course. Well, let's get back to your question. Wavelength is normally referred to in meters. And I've always used the formula somewhat abbreviated. You know, the formula is actually the velocity of the wave divided by the frequency in megahertz. And if you stop and think about this, there are about 300 million meters in a second when you're looking at the velocity of a rascal like this. So I simply just make the math a little easier, and I use 300 without all of the zeros, and I divide it by the frequency in megacycles. So in this case, if you took 300 and divided it by 25, you would come up with a wavelength being 12 meters. Now, let me put some more poison in the bottle. And let me buy a nickel while I'm doing it. If you take that question a little further and you say, well, how long is the wavelength at 25 megahertz? You know, the formula is 468 divided by the frequency in megahertz, and that comes out to 18.72 feet. So, if this radar at 25 megahertz needs to have a half wave in the wave before it gets reflected back, the world's coming to an end. KY6V, go ahead, George.
KY6V, NO70. Yes, that is why the coastal radar tends to go some slight to the higher frequencies. But some of these ocean waves at depth can be pretty significant, and I'm sure the chief could tell us more about that for sure. And I'm just going to stick with what I saw in the documentation out there, too. The three typical HF operating frequencies that were mentioned in the literature that produce Bragg scattering and their corresponding ocean wavelengths are, as Gordon said, 25 megahertz transmission would give a 12 meter EM wave, which would translate by half wavelength to a 6-meter ocean wave. Ocean wave would have to be 6 meters high with a 25 megahertz radar transmission. If it were only a 12 megahertz radar transmission, that leads to a 25-meter electromagnetic wave, which would then detect a 12.5-meter ocean wave. Well, what was that movie that about a storm off sea, offshore? And then, of course, a 5-megahertz transmission would be looking for a 60-meter electromagnetic wave, where then the ocean wave would have to be 30 meters high. Gordon, you're right. That's getting serious. So to get an accurate reading of coastal waves using coastal radar and to detect ships on and maybe even under the ocean surface because of temperature diffraction from the ships that can cause changes in the wave height over time, we have to scan multiple times at different wavelengths over short changes in time and combine information streams from other technological resources. In other words, you want to have a 4-meter wave, a 3.5-meter wave, a 5-meter wave high, a 6-meter high ocean wave, all of these, and you're only going to see those on the radar when they're equal to 1/2 of the radar wavelength. So the more you scan, the more complete and frequent your scans, the more complete your return data would be, which you then store in the supercomputer for it to do its massaging and come back to you with an answer of known or unknown events, and is it a tsunami on the way? Now, maritime, environmental, homeland security, and military interests, therefore, are served by coastal radar sites, both fixed and portable. When coastal radar and input streams from other sources are combined, a very complete picture of near shore and offshore interests and incursions are easily mapped. And yes, incursions can even be military incursions. An illustration of coastal radar capability when combined with multiple input streams from other systems is shown at link 68B on the SouthCar's website reference material page. That is a picture that shows a lot of different input methods, and this picture was constructed from the use of coastal radar and other input streams in surveillance, land radar, satellite overseas. There's a whole lot of sources that went into making that picture. An external view of a coastal radar installation in Japan is at link 68C. So why don't we start taking a look at a coastal radar resetting link. So inside the building shown on link 68C as in Charlie are the transceiver, controller, processor, communications, and aerial switching consoles in custom-built cabinets. The aerial switcher and communications consoles are shown in link 68D. Also inside the building at the same operator position are the transceiver and receiver coastal radar units as shown in link 68E as in Echo. And then if you were to walk along behind these operators toward the end of the desk located off the end of the operator positions are the antenna coupler and switcher units as shown in link 68F. The part of the operator console positions closest to the coupler and switcher units can be seen more easily by the grouping of hanging microphones that is shown in link 68C, where you will see 3 microphones on the console hanging next to each other, and that's the position that's closest to the coupler and switcher units. So, TIN members and guests, the question has been asked about what the OTH and coastal radar returns actually look like. You know, I still have had difficulty finding a good sample because they have been so many progressions in technology, so many unpublished results, so many classified results, military, even business intelligence guarded secrets and so forth. So I kind of had to talk about ideas I had from reading the literature and saying, all right, how could they put this together? You know, I've not been able to find really a good sample of actual radar returns, to include in this TIN. So I'm going to ask the NET's forbearance and share with you where my imagination went to using the examples we have seen so far. So maybe you can use your imagination to take a little trip with me on a coastal radar scan and see what we can learn from that scan. Because so much about modern radar returns is still classified, then we can kind of only use our imagination. We can use the basic capabilities of coastal radar to see changes in ocean wave height and changes in wave height from differences in water temperature. It also seems probable that once we have these radar images that are going into the supercomputer and it's starting to generate an image of its radar returns, and then the supercomputer goes into all that metadata we were talking about and combines it with other sources and starts to generate a picture like the one we saw earlier with all the different input streams shown, it seems probable to me that the next step around the corner, if we haven't already gotten there, are that virtual reality glasses and full wall-height TVs may be used like the ones used in television crime dramas when the investigators shift the different photos or images around on the wall and try to figure out who done it by looking at the images up on the wall. And perhaps instead of doing that upon a wall, why can we not use virtual reality glasses? And now the supercomputer puts us right there on the battlefield where the image is not only the coastal radar return, but the simulated battlefield from all of these input sources. So is it possible that this same virtual technology then can be used to create a battlefield image? And can it also be used to create a cyber warfare battlefield? We know that cyber warfare is becoming more important nowadays. And, you know, a lot of those games do have, in the virtual reality, an image of the terrain that the cyber warfare battle is being carried out on. What if that image matched a maritime battlefield like Chief would have served with his boat on, I presume? Forgive me, Chief, if I overspoke there. So, you know, is it possible that we can create a virtual reality cyber warfare battlefield or even a physical battlefield looking in these virtual reality glasses and then see what the coastal battlefield would look like? Now, I do think this is happening already with the ease of the younger generations of people who have grown up playing virtual reality games. Think of a wildly popular computer or a smartphone game that you have tried to yourself, maybe played yourself. Now, let's imagine that that game's virtual landscape matches a real-life battlefield that is in action somewhere in the world. Now, imagine that that real-life terrestrial battlefield may actually be a landscape, a cyber warfare landscape with its own buildings, its own armed forces, its own infrastructure, its own tributaries, rivers, lands, its own people, civilization, buildings, structures, that what the computer has constructed may actually match a real-life urban profile. Now, imagine that there is a wildly successful attack profile that almost guarantees success in that cyber game. In other words, these young people know how to play that game and win, no matter on any of the battlefields. Much like that, there are well-known chess moves that almost guarantee success depending upon the earlier history of moves in the chess game. So now that we have considered virtual battlefields, both real battlefields and cyber battlefields, let's ask ourselves a question that could win the cyber war or the battlefield conflict. Why can't an artificial supercomputer take a cyber attack profile, apply the same processing algorithms used for radar analysis and match that radar image to a resulting profile in a known cyber game that one of these contemporary soldiers is extremely skilled at playing in the cyber warfare, cyber game, Homeland Security. And once the battlefield scenario matches a known game, and there is one soldier that is known to be especially experienced and proficient with that game, why cannot the supercomputer switch the battle to the warrior best suited for that conflict and who would have the better chance of winning the match? Now, NET members, I do think this may already be happening or have already happened. It's just that they're not telling us. So for the fun of it here, okay, let's create our own virtual reality coastal radar intelligence gathering scenario. Let's use our imagination about how the supercomputer can take the radar returns to show us what the radar is seeing and why. You may remember that last TIN, Gordon was kind enough to play some radar wave files for us, and he's going to again later on in this TIN tonight. So we found out that he was playing those from the super secret, ultra secret South Car's underground wave file vault, where Gordon plays the audio files and keeps the coffee pot warm for Chief Admiral and our net manager. Let's use coastal radar to look at wave diffractions, thermal impacts on the ocean wave surface, and wave height changes from one part of the surf to the other. Okay, we're going to go looking for Gordon and the Chief. All right, and I left the G off of the word looking on purpose. Okay, I see you on the coastal radar return. And this is fictitious, fellow hams and shortwave listeners and people interested. Okay, fictitiously. You know, I see on the coastal radar return a spot where it appears that an underground facility is causing a drag on the ocean surface waves. This creates a slightly different wave pattern on the surface of the ocean that is easily seen on the radar, and it appears that this slightly different pattern on the surface of the ocean almost appears to be square in shape like a building. I also see a difference in the wave pattern of looking at several adjacently placed coastal radars that have seem to be resulting from a temperature difference of the water that's also causing a change in the ocean wave pattern. That same temperature pattern has been observed previously by the computer and stored in its metadata set when warm river waters from an urban environment spills over into the ocean. So the radar return shows an underwater square shape disrupting the surface waves and of a warmer temperature than a few feet away from the return pattern. Okay, I just noticed that I was doubling with someone. So let me invite KD0NZT first and then Bernie next. So forgive me for doubling with you. KD0NZT in 070, over to you. Nothing heard? Okay, Bernie, KA9WDX, over to you. Please come aboard.
KA9WDX, Portal here, I'd like to come through. If my light keyed up, I don't know, maybe something happened there, I don't know. Maybe somebody tried to check in coming through my link, or possibly somebody may have brought up my 440 repeater. You know, that's for some reason, sometimes it causes my echoing to key up briefly. I'm not sure why it does that. It usually doesn't, though. same way with HF. Usually doesn't bother my echoing, but once in a great while, the HF will key up the echoing thing, too, especially during wet weather. And it's been kind of damp and wet all week long here. So I just thought I'd check in anyway, since you called me. Just riding bike. You probably hear the bumps in the road. Some of the sheets are a little bit rough here. So back to you. I didn't really have anything to contribute to the net there, but I just thought it would be interesting to listen to. Back to net, K9WDX.
K9WDX and net and a 7-0. Well, I'm glad you're here tonight, Bernie. Thank you. And looks like I doubled with your link repeater that came in. But I'm glad you're there with us tonight. Thank you for being there. All right, since I was doubling, let me go back and repeat where I believe I left off. So in our fictitious scenario that I'm describing to you with your patients tonight, and there's a point coming to this, I see from these coastal radar returns in my mind's eye a difference in the wave pattern on either side of that square in the ocean of this underwater structure that seems to be coming from a temperature difference of the water that causes a change in the wave pattern. Now, that same temperature pattern has been observed when warm waters from an urban environment spills over into the ocean. So we're seeing temperature patterns from this building, underwater square-shaped building that we noticed with a little bit of difference in the wave height, there's a temperature difference also causing a radar return. So the square image appears to fluctuate some, like looking through a campfire heat plume. So there may be a heat source from inside this square underground structure, something like computer servers, repeaters, and a high-capacity coffee pot. That last word was coffee pot. Okay. So, however, because of the Bragg principle, it takes several radar scans of multiple wavelengths to observe the different temperatures in the heat fluctuations that cause those slightly different wave heights. Okay, so now we have our multiple radar scans. It's time to look for a baseline radar image and compare it to any previously completed scans that are stored in the supercomputer. Let's ask the supercomputer if there are any other places in the scan that look like the same return. If it does see those similar places, it may then only be the ocean bottoms and peaks and valleys. If there is no similar return anywhere, and this is a new underground structure, it may be a man-made underground structure instead of a natural wave event from the ocean surface. So I just checked with the supercomputer, and there are no other returns like this. So there's something underwater, square in shape. You know, hey, Net, maybe we just found in this imaginary scenario the ultra-secret South Carr's wave file vault with a coffee pot heat plume, which, of course, was have to be a significant coffee pot, but that's reasonable considering the fact that Chief W4RFJ is around as well. So, with a small but focused temperature differential in the water, We look for anything around, and oh my goodness, there's something approaching the building. It's smaller than the building, therefore the ocean wave impact is much less because of its smaller size, and it takes a different audio amplitude of longer duration on the radar to see the smaller wave diffraction. It must be the chief submersible goat locker submarine headed for there. Now, by the way, I learned since then that the chief doesn't ride in anything that deliberately sinks, but he was kind enough to say, instead of making me rewrite this, to be a good sport. And let me say that in this fictional account, there is a submersible headed for the South Carr's ultra-secret wave file vault that we just found using coastal radar. Now, checking the thermal effect on the ocean waves using this coastal radar return, we also see a temperature-reflective underwater labeling on the side of the underwater building, and that label appears to have a coffee can on top and a thermal absorption decal of a coffee pot on the side, according to a sonar return with thermal detection. Looks like the chief is out of coffee again, and the admiral needs him to restock her coffee supply so that she can have coffee for him at the next AM connection, which is on South Carr's on Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. It must be the chief heading for this previously undetected South Carr's wave file vault that was hidden until we used coastal radar to look at wave heights and the effective temperature on the water itself and on the waves. I never knew that the Admiral in the Chief's coat locker was a submersible, but I guess it's not. It's what he told me now. But at least now we know where the South Car's top secret wave file facility is, because we had this imaginary coastal radar. Yes, this was a fictional account because I could not find an actual display. The reason that we cannot really find actual displays may be that the radar returns are combined with many other input streams to create a battlefield with more detail than only one technology can provide. And now that seems likely to me, and that is mentioned in the available literature. So thank you for bearing with my flight of fancy for a fictional case study of a radar return. Okay, so, hey, Chief, now that this submersible, which I understand now you are not in, now that this submersible has docked at this super-secret South Car's underwater wave file facility to refill your coffee cup, could you please use your spy pocket pen and open channel S for South Car Surf and tell us more about HARP ionograms and digisons? So calling Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kurakin on South Cars, W4RFJ from NO70. Over.
Give me a second. I messed up. This is W4RFJ, and I had my spot in the script, and I lost it. Okay. Well, last TIN, and I got to tell everybody, I was lured aboard that submarine with a nice hot cup of hazelnut Wawa coffee, and that's hard to turn down. Anyway, last TIN, the question was asked about what a radar return display looks like after a computer processes the signal. The answer is that computer models and predictive statistical analysis have improved so much that a supercomputer can take multiple inputs and combine them to create a display that resembles a graph or an ionogram to communicate what the radar is seeing. The ionogram, this is not a good word for me, is not only the radar image itself. The ionospheric radar return is a set of numbers and values rather than physical image, such as an airplane or a tank return. Another interesting item for HARP is the topic of airglow. A web search on the topic will provide interesting examples of visible airglow in the sky. There is much discussion by concerned citizens living in the vicinity of HARP as to whether the radar causes an actual air glow visible to the naked eye. That said, measurements during heating experiments definitely show that ionospheric air glow can also be caused by ionospheric heating. Let me grab a nickel. Okay, what's going on? Unkey. Oh, I know what's going on. Okay, I apologize. You know, I'm trying to finagle two different programs here. Ionospheric heating is discussed by EISCAT at TRUMSA. Observed air glow in the column is described in section 3.2.5 of a publication entitled Introduction to Ionospheric Heating at TRUMSA. I think that's dash one. Air glow was observed in the heating column from strong heater-induced Langmuir waves that can result in enhanced air glow of the red 6300 angstrom oxygen line, 1.96 electron volt threshold, and to a smaller degree of the green 5577 angstrom oxygen line, 4.17 electron volt threshold. And if you believe I recalled that information off the top of my head, you got another thing coming, because I couldn't even repeat that twice. To address the question of what a radar return would look like after a computer process of a signal, we can look at some examples. One would be an ionogram from the more accurate digisond of a HARP transmission. Let me grab another nickel. Okay, the polarization of a linear this is not a good night, guys and gals. The polarization of a linearly polarized signal can change on its way through the ionosphere, which is called a Faraday rotation. A linearly polarized signal is decomposed into two components, one circularly and one elliptically polarized. So we're talking circularly polarized and elliptically polarized. Now, circularly polarized, we use that with a lot of satellite stuff, so that might help you understand that one. The propagation speed of both components in the ionosphere differ due to the Earth's magnetic field. When both radar signal polarization components are added again after their journey through the ionosphere, their phases are no longer the same as when they entered the ionosphere, then their sum does not have the same polarization. Radar polarization recombination into a new phase can be seen on certain ionograms in the form of a split waveform at a certain altitude. The split waveform looks like a nose with a fainter echo to the right. See X-axis reference 27 at link 69. Let me grab another nickel. Okay, many ionosounders have been replaced by newer digisounds. These do not simply transmit a carrier whose frequency increases in 100 kHz per second, but a digitally modulated signal that covers a shortwave spectrum in 25 kHz steps. This provides an improved detail in the signal return. The vertical axis here is the vertical height where a reflecting layer would have to give the measured propagation time. It is defined as a time divided by the twice the speed of light as seen in link 69-1. Let me get another reset. So the ionogram is used for HARP facilities. For radar facilities, the use of waterfall displays shows the radar modulation audio and tells us more about the reflected images. NO70 will now talk to us about the waterfall images from the over-the-horizon and coastal radars and where the water goes when it gets to the bottom of the waterfall display. It's usually filling my coffee pot. Personally, the Admiral and I use it to brew our coffee. It has that extra buzz from the ionized, you can tell I'm already drinking it because I can't even pronounce ionized water. NO70, pick her up. The chief needs rescuing. W4RFJ.
W4RFJ, NO70. You know, Chief, you are such a good sport. It would not be the same on the TIN without your being there. Thank you. Chief has just answered the question from last TIN about what a radar display looks like. And we looked at the return from one of the ionospheric heating radars. So we're going to move from that into spectral display and analysis. Now, if I may, I'm going to want to go back just for a moment to the link that the chief mentioned, that link 69. If you pull that up, you will see out there at the vertical reference where it's number 27 on the x-axis labels down there, you will see that there's a fainter second image of that nose out to the right. And that fainter secondary return is related partly to the two different polarizations that Chief mentioned. So now we are talking about, in ionospheric heating, polarized radio signals, which we as hams have a great deal of interest in. So, Chief, I want to thank you for bringing that to our attention and reminding us about it. Let me reset. Okay, so I have just learned, in addition to that, from Chief, that the secret to a good cup of coffee is the waterfall display that we're going to be looking at here. The water that comes out of the bottom of the waterfall display, Gordon, thanks to Gordon KY6V for that. And now that we know how to get ionized coffee for the best coffee, the beans have finally been spilled. Okay. Back to fewer puns. The net knows I can't help it. You know, that comes out of the NO70 shack. Can't help it. Okay, so are there any net stations tonight who can tell me what the y-axis represents on a waterfall spectrum display? maybe somebody out here took a look at the South Carolina's website early and pulled pulled a few of the images up or something. I'd love to know if anyone can tell me what on a waterfall spectrum display the y-axis represents. First station to get the right answer receives a round of applause, unkeyed on the mic from the other net members, but we want to give you a round of applause. First station that can tell me what the y-axis represents on a waterfall spectrum display, please call NO70 now. Over. Okay, nothing heard. All right, well, we'll go in and proceed, and you'll get to see it here, okay? By the way, just we mentioned this earlier in the net. For those of you that are joining us, just a note about the reference page on the South Carolina's website and the pace of the Echolink audio from the net here. Please note that the Echolink audio is by necessity shorter than the reference material or resources available through the links. You can certainly go back and make a notation of the links that you're interested in, go back and take a look, read more information about it, make more sense about the Bragg principle and the scattering and ionospheric heating and displays and virtual reality, a display of battlefields, maritime and land bases, and so forth. You know, you can have a lot of fun with that, so invite you back to the South Carolina's website. Okay. So now we move from ionograms to waterfall display images that we promised to you earlier tonight. A waterfall display allows us to look at a wider audio spectrum over time than a spectrum display. We place time on the y-axis instead of the x-axis and allow the time to move with the display of the changing audio pattern, also moving in a vertical direction, whether it be top to bottom or bottom to top. We can then more easily see audio node patterns and pairs that may otherwise be hidden in a horizontal time display like you would see on a conventional oscilloscope. There is an excellent example of waterfall image of intermittent signals at link 69A. And I am going to pause here for about 15 seconds to give you a chance to click on that and observe that intermittent signal waterfall display so that the rest of this net makes sense. So let me allow you a good 15 to 20 seconds to play link 69A if you so desire. This is NO70. This is NO70 continuing with the South Carolina's Thursday informational net tonight. Thank you for being with us. So the best way to understand the value of a waterfall display in signal processing is to practice how to analyze a few of them. So would you please allow me now to help you with a few? Maybe you might enjoy some of these. We will start with a conventional horizontal oscilloscope-like display and then move to a few like oscilloscope display, and that will show you how the radar pattern changes over time. Let me give a 20-second pause for you to listen to that. This is NO70. Okay, now, that after you've heard that one, there's a waterfall display of a single beacon-like tone. Now, what we saw before was the oscilloscope-like pattern. We're now going to shift from the time from the x-axis to the y-axis, and then you're going to see the time marks and how they move and compare the audio to the waveform display when you play link 69C as in Charlie. So let me pause for about 25 seconds for you to listen to 69 Charlie. This is NO70. Okay, this is the South Carolina's Technical Information Net. So you've now seen where the time axis got flipped over to the vertical side instead of the horizontal. I'm just going to read through and refer you all to later listen to the other links or watch them for yourselves, and I'll describe to you what you'll be seeing in the links. So at the next link, you may apply what you've learned so far to multiple waveforms. Look at the timestamps on the left side of the waterfall display, and you'll see the time is on the x-axis and the time mark moves as well on the waterfall image. Note that we're not covering the spectral display at the top of the image in this tie-in. So now look again at the first waterfall and then look at the waterfall display in the middle. See if you can pick out all the changes in the display at the extreme left and right when you later check out link 69D. you'll see a lot of changes in the display. Now, in 69E, we're going to look at a display of the WWVH time standard transmission, radio transmission. I'm sure as ham radio operators or shortwave listeners, we've all looked at WWV or WWVH for time reference. So there is at link 69E a spectral display of the reception of WWVH. That's at 69E. Then after you watch 69E, then you'll go to, you can go to 69F, and you're going to see in that display with the radar a lot of slanted dark lines in the waterfall display as time progresses at link 69F. And then you're going to see paired emissions with different shifts in between frequencies with waterfall displays where you may not be able to hear the sound but be able to see the display. So notice the paired emissions at audio sidebands on both sides in link 69G. Let me reset. So, and in 69H, you can listen for the sloped audio frequency at 4.785 megahertz and look for the slanted lines in the middle of the display at 69H. So with those links in 69B through H, I believe it was, you will see all the different waterfall displays. The takeaway from this is that as you look at waterfall displays, you're going to see time on the vertical axis, the signal falling down through the display, coming out the bottom of the display, or out the top if the time is inverted, and you will see on either side of the frequency a range of frequencies for the audio sidebands, which then give you a unique pattern specific to that radar. And the sound of the radar, again, can be very specific and unique to each individual radar station. So, I want to apologize to Gordon. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I've really messed that one up. And I want to apologize to Chief for putting him on a sub underwater. Hey, but at least that's the camaraderie of ham radio, isn't it? Do all experiments work? I guess not. Okay, so anyway, hey, net members and shortwave listeners and guests, as you examine these waterfall displays, were you able to see the slightly slanted horizontal lines that match the sloping audio pitch? You know, if you place link 69J on the South Cars website, you will see that the operator clicks a lower sideband, upper sideband, double sidebands to look at the waterfall displays that are represented by each of those sidebands. Now, a radar signal return of any mode is dependent upon measurement of the time delay of the return signal, meaning that radar has to have a less time of the radar wave to go out and come back to see a return. Without this time measurement, the distance and presence of an object cannot be determined. So we want to invite you to try to analyze the WWV pattern at 10 megahertz, followed by multiple signals on other frequencies. Can you, the operator is going to change the frequency of the waterfall display in the middle of the recording. Now, can you, just by watching the waterfall display without the sound known, tell when the operator has received it to a different frequency? If you can tell when the spectral or waterfall display changes just by looking at the display, you will then have met the objective of being able to use a waterfall display with processing tonight. This is NO70. So remember then that radar works by measuring the time required for a radar signal to travel to its target and to return. Backscatter radar works by measuring multiple returns from the same transmission, each with its own different return time, and because the backscatter radiation is bouncing off of other objects and adding multiple different times to the return radar trace. So now, because time is so important to radar returns and analysis. I was wondering if any NET members remember something that happened two times last year about time and something called a leap second. I'd like to invite anyone on the NET to say if you observed or remembered the leap seconds from last year. Please call NO7N. Okay, well, I guess those leap seconds, yeah, the leap seconds kind of passed me by too as well. But because the Earth's rotation is slowing down, then the Earth's day is getting longer by an extra second. And it turns out that to keep the time in sync with the Earth's actual rotation, that twice in 2015, they had to add an extra leap second into the clocks to keep our atomic clocks in sync with actual Earth time. And Link 69L shows you a waterfall display where WWV added in that leap second. So was the leap second actually in the blank one-second gap above the vertical red line, or as shown by the vertical red line itself in the WWV waterfall display? Now, what was interesting is that when these leap seconds were added in, because a lot of social media sites used a particular operating system, then there are about 8 social media sites that crashed when the leap second was added because the time synchronization became unsynchronized with the addition of that extra leap second. So why would we add the leap second if it's going to crash so many computers in the world, and when do they happen? Well, again, we had to do it in 2015, and it may happen again within the next couple of years where more leap seconds have to be added. It was worth the risk because there are critical uses of these time signals, whether it be in terms of the internet performance, whether it be in terms of space station, aeronautical engineering, civil engineering, business matters, you know, all of this is important, even to the stock market timing. So these other needs also have to be considered, and that's why a leap second has to be added, even if it means that certain internet media sites are disrupted. Okay, so this concludes this special South Cars Thursday Information Net series on high-power RF ionospheric heating, air glow and other effects of ionospheric heating, over-the-horizon radars, including backscatter, international and domestic impacts on residents, other nations, impacts on intelligence gathering and military applications, covert radio surveillance methods, virtual reality applications, coastal radar, international impact on international broadcasts, impacts of high-power RF international transmissions on amateur radio and shortwave listening skills and techniques, and human intelligence and signals intelligence applications of high-power two-way and one-way covert and clandestine radio communications, as well as coastal radar applications, surveillance of maritime interests, detection of ecological damage or events, detecting above ground and underwater structures for civilian and military uses, for example, oil derricks under construction that one nation may not know about, and many, many other applications. Did you realize, as a TIN NET member from South Cars, that you have learned so much about so many topics in less than a month, about 3 weeks? My hat is off to each of you on the South Cars and as members of the Technical Information NET. You've learned a lot. You have been, you've worked through all of these. You've been patient. You've been present for the NETs. And I want to say congratulations to you for having taken the effort to further your interest, knowledge, and professionalism in our hobby of ham radio. Break. So now it is time to kick back and have a little fun with what we have learned, using the basics and our imaginations to fill in the rest. After all, we amateur radio operators are experimenters at heart, and interested in a very rare and very public service-oriented hobby. Chief always breaks me up in the text box. I'm sorry, Ned. I can't help it. Let's have a tongue-in-cheek fun quiz. You know, after we learn so much, I mean, I don't want to read that list again, but that's what you learned, Ned, okay? The fellow South Cars members and guests, you learned all of that. So let's have a tongue-in-cheek fun quiz after all the hard work we put in and have some laughs. Let's see if we can apply or if you can apply your new knowledge about high-power radar, coastal radar, extraterrestrial communications, and waterfall displays to answer the following humorous questions when you view Link 82 later after the net, which is a little bit of a movie. So here are the questions you want to look for when you view that movie. At 2 minutes into the movie, when they call the lunar base from the base point, were they using an ionospheric duct to communicate with the lunar base or something different? At 3 minutes and 32 in, is the computer display waveform in the background behind the actors and over the horizon radar return or a more conventional radar return? And yes, after you look at the waterfall displays tonight, you'll know the answer. Question 3, at 7 minutes and 29 seconds, was a HARP duct required to communicate with the moon? Just a little hint or clue, remember that HARP only analyzes the ionosphere, okay? Now here's the really big important question too. At question 4, at 7 minutes and 56 seconds in, you'll on the radar antenna behind the actors, you will see a copper-colored coffee can radar antenna feeder element. Or is it a radar antenna feeder element, or is it the Chief W4RFJ's forgotten coffee pot? Let me reset the link. Question 6, about 8 minutes and 10 seconds into the movie, is the antenna you see behind the actors and over the horizon array or a direct return radar? And then about 8 minutes to 20 to 920, as that radar antenna twirls around, is the RF exposure of the people standing in front of the radar within safe limits? Okay, so the answers to that are the following. A reception from a signal from outside our solar system may not be a naturally made RF emission. So, you know, that they'd have to be using something besides just a simple radio transmission or radar. And then it's more likely for answer number 3 that it was a high-power RF moon bounce with a reception dish like the one located at Cheltenham Navy Base in Maryland that we mentioned in Tie-In 1. And then as far as question 7, with the radar antenna right behind those actors with the RF radio mission, I don't think I'd want to be standing there. I'll let you come up with the other answers and look at them. And this is posted again on the website for you to see. Okay, so this is the end of the Thursday informational net. And let me turn it over back for any questions, comments, concerns, thoughts. If you feel you've learned anything tonight and want to share it with us, would love to hear that as well. Let's spend a couple of minutes just to kind of get to know what each other may have learned from tonight. Let me open it back up for any questions or comments. This is NO70. Over.
N1PXD, got a question or a comment.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate that. N1VXP in the group, NO70.
Yeah, that radar was interesting when it came to tsunamis. I myself have watched several very good documentary programs concerning tsunamis, the damage, and as well as how they are formed. And I just, my mind goes kind of questionable on whether the radar could actually pick up the wave form on a tsunami, especially so far out at sea. only because from what I've been able to see on this one program, it said the wave is actually not very big at all. In fact, it's a series of waves. They're only about maybe a foot or a foot and a half high, if any, all because of the when the tsunami wave is generated, it's the first one is not the strongest. It's usually second or third as being the strongest ones, but they're spread out so far vertically, from the surface down. Let me drop for a second. On one of the tsunamis that went through an area that caused so much damage, there were people out scuba diving underwater, and they had no idea that any kind of a tsunami went through. A little bit of current disruption, but they kind of figured that's pretty well norm. But it wasn't until they came back up to the surface when they saw a lot of the debris and bodies floating in the water that they realized something major had happened. They had no idea what attacked the on the radar, a wave that's they said it was very little, but it wasn't until it came close to the shore that it actually had all the power. It was going from very deep up to shallow, that the power of the waves, and it was actually the second wave that was the one that came in and really caused so much trouble, that these waves are not your typical surface waves, but deep down. And if you can imagine, 300 feet up to 10 feet, the wave itself is generated. It causes all that destruction, has nowhere to go but forward. Quite an interesting thing. Let me drop for a second. You know, quite an interesting topic on the radar, but I think it might, I know, personally I felt that it was really good to have a background understanding with the current tsunami technology that they're doing, that it really makes a difference. But, you know, it's just another aspect of marine science that's quite interesting. Back to you, N1VXP.
N1VXP, NO70. No, Rick, I really appreciate the comments that you made, and that those are excellent, excellent points. Let's take a little closer look at several of the points you made there, Rick. First, in regard to tsunami detection, we know that it takes a lot of coastal radars to be placed closely together, and they look pretty much straight out. The other is that we know that it's only good for about 200 kilometers out. However, the tsunamis, yes, typically have are pretty much undetectable in terms of wave height further out at sea, but they move a different speed and a different wave height than is normal for that part of the ocean water surface. This is why it's so important to build the metadata of supercomputer storage that is then used to compare the radar return against. And then when that supercomputer makes the comparison, it notices that, oh, and this does not look like the normal pattern that we've seen for the past 2-year average of this part of the ocean. This looks like the tsunami wave patterns that we have seen earlier in some other part of the world but now we're it's looking like a tsunami wave pattern in this particular radar's view. So there may be a risk here at this radar's range of a tsunami occurring. So that's, for one point, that's why the supercomputer metadata library storage is so important and is having massive amounts of money thrown at it for storage of that data and servers. Let me reset. And thank you, Rick. Second is, yes, the waves do travel quick on the surface, and it's a matter of the relative movement. You mentioned the swimmers being unaware of what's happening above them, but they probably have been also swept a far distance, like a riptide, a rip current might sweep them. Again, it depends on the characteristics of that particular tsunami. The idea being that the tsunami is detectable, but also because the tsunami wavelength or wave height is smaller but so variable, and keeping in mind the Bragg scattering principle, I know I keep coming back to Bragg, but that's the reality of coastal radar, that it has to match that wavelength, so a lot of returns come back, and those returns would be atypical for where that tsunami is located when compared against the computer metadata storage. And by the time you do all this cross-checking and double-checking and threat isolation and so forth, it's possible to come up with a good probability of a tsunami detection. Now, you raise very good points. Can there be points of failure? Perhaps Chief. you know, Rick, I hope you're seeing what Chief is sending at me, the text box here. So Rick, I hear you loud and clear, and I'm learning from you as well, but can you comment, and you may know more about parts of this than I. I'd love to hear more, any additional comment from you with the thoughts I just had regarding the tsunami detection. Back to you, Rick, N1VXP in the group, NL70.
Well, N1VXP here. It's still an ongoing learning, and as far as putting detectors up, that's one help on the waves. But like I put in the text box, they can travel up to 600 miles per hour, which is quite a thing. All you may see on the tsunami wave, of course, if it's if you see this, then you know you're way too late. If all of a sudden the water retreats from the shoreline to the point where you have a beach area that's like maybe a half a mile or a mile out, it's all dry, well, that's too late, because that wave will be coming back in very shortly, and there's no way to outrun it. And, you know, the whole idea is that, like I say, I forget which one of the tsunamis it was. They had a couple of people out scuba diving, and they had no idea of anything going on until they actually came up to the surface. Couldn't find their boat. It was gone. And they actually saw a lot of debris falling, floating back out from shore, and as well as bodies. They knew something was definitely wrong. So they had no feeling whatsoever, other than maybe a little bit of current shifting around, but they had no idea. Let me drop for a second. So, like I say, if you find any YouTube, I know there's been several different History Channel programs and Smithsonian Channel programs, as well as stuff even on the Weather Channel, that they've actually done quite a bit on the tsunamis, and trying to actually warn people, you know, how they can get the warning out to people and what to expect. And they concern the fact that not only is it the West Coast, but the East Coast as well. The Atlantic can also have them. They are actually predicting one possible on the Atlantic side that may come up. And just the fact that when they say, okay, a tsunami is on its way, you know exactly what you have to do to get higher up to higher ground and not wait around, not fly around or think about any kind of a hurricane watching or any severe storms. When they say a tsunami is coming, this goes on the West Coast as well. They do that warning, you got to move and go inland, up, away from the otherwise, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff on the internet for that. Really makes a big difference and works well with the coastal radar, N1VXP.
N1VXP, NO70. You know, and one more question, Rick, because obviously you do know a lot about the tsunamis. Do I remember correctly from the documentaries that the tsunamis gain the height of the wave, the visible height of the wave, you know, from the terrain to the top of the wave as the tsunami moves from deep sea and as the ocean surface rises up toward land? Is that where the tsunami wave gains its height, Rick? Do I remember that correctly? N1VXP, NO70.
Yes, that's correct. And it's not necessarily the first wave. It could be the second or third that are really the most destructive. But, you know, just the fact that one comes in, people think, oh, well, it's over. That's not necessarily the case. Most of the times, it's the second and third wave that really have all the power. And there's no way to control them. Once they occur, there's no way to kind of break it up and say, okay, we can get rid of it. It's nature's way of saying, hey, time to clear the beach. And, you know, like people think, oh, well, you can try to disrupt a hurricane. Tsunamis, they have their own mind, and they can do what they want. And you just have to watch out for them. N1VXP.
N1VXP and the group, the NO70. Well, thank you, Rick. You know, and that your comments have really helped put a lot of the discussion tonight into perspective, because it's so easy to get caught up with all of the material that's out there, and it can be hard to pull back and give a good summarizing sentence. And I think you did that, so thank you for the help in doing that. Your discussion of the tsunami was just an excellent summarization. That's what this hobby is about, where we all learn from each other, and I've learned from you tonight, and I know other net members have as well. And I would love to hear from any other net members who might have any comments about what you've learned tonight, any comments about your love for the seashore. Has this coastal radar subject given you an improved respect for the ocean, or an improved love for your hobby, beachman, whatever? Any other net members with any comments, thoughts, additional information, please come now. Call NO70. Over.
RFJ.
W4RFJ, NO70 ESG.
Well, I wanted to thank you and Gordon for putting that all that stuff together. It really was a lot of information, and I'm still chugging on it. But most of all, I'm going to let Gordon explain to you what hot racking is. Good night, everybody. I got to roll. 4:30 comes real early for me. 7:03 all around. Thanks, George.
Thank you, Chief. I really appreciate it. Any other stations? I would love to hear comments, thoughts, observations, information that I missed tonight that should have been included. that we're all in it to learn together. So any other station with any thoughts, comments, please call now. And everyone who's joined the net tonight for the Thursday Informational Network, it has been just a fantastic time to share this with you. I want to thank all of the people who helped put this together, and especially Kathy, the net manager, Gordon, the ever-patient script editor and encourager and motivator, Chief, the person who has always helped me interested and engaged. Well, that said, that this has been the South Carr's Technical Thursday Information Network tonight with part two of the coastal radar and waterfall display and follow-up to the ionospheric heating display questions. As we mentioned, you've learned, as you've looked through this, look at the topic list of what you learned. So my hat is off to you, the Net South Carr's members, guests, shortwave listeners, and others. This has been South Carr's, the Thursday Information Network, and we encourage you to learn more about South Carr's at vyp.southcarrs.com. We want to invite you for the upcoming South Carr's Nets. The next is going to be this coming Saturday morning with the AM Connection at 8 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and then the noon Saturday Intercontinental Net at noon Eastern Time, and then on Saturday and Sunday evening, the evening RAGSU time. So we'd like to invite you to those events. Thank you.